yesterday we're talking to David Coventry, author David Coventry, about his new book Performance, which is out now. Good morning to you, David. How are things in Diamond Harbour?
Good morning. It's a still day. Looks pretty outside. It's always pretty in Diamond Harbour.
Now, before we get talking about the book, I want to talk about Hail Meteor, which is a post-hardcore punk band that you're in. And you all are releasing a bunch of tracks. Does the band have any big plans for the year? Release an EP or an album or something?
Yeah, we're releasing an album in October. We've released a couple of singles this year along the way, because we recorded last October, we recorded the drums for 13 songs, and it's taken me a long, long time to get everything else stuck on to the album. Yeah, the album comes out in October, which will be fun.
Very exciting. Is it coming out in Libra season? Is it coming out before the 22nd of October?
It's coming out the 10th, I think.
It's a week after my birthday.
Yeah. Awesome. Oh, cool. Well, same, actually.
Really? Are you born October 3rd?
The 2nd.
The 2nd? Twinning. Oh, my gosh. Who would have thought? A couple of Libras, eh?
Right. Some decades apart, though.
Oh, there's a kindred spirit there, David. Don't deny it.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
Now, before we delve into the book's subject matter, I want to mention the fact that you left high school when you were 16, and now 3 years ago, in 2022, you finished a PhD, that's like a total end of the education spectrum, so to speak. I want to know, why did you leave high school at 16, and how did your education journey shape up between that moment and enrolling at university?
The thing about ME, CFS, Melodic Emphysema, for myelitis, the disease that I have and what Performance, the novel, is about. Most people who have it have usually had the Epstein-Barr virus, which is what causes glandular fever. And when I was 15, I got a really bad bout of glandular fever. I was off school for about 3 months, I guess. And when I came back, everything was different and strange, and I didn't understand it. I felt like I did understand it, actually, to tell the truth. I felt like I really understood it and nobody else did. It wasn't really any point in me being there. I had no interest in it anymore. Prior to that, school was easy. I was a sports guy. I was in all the top sports teams and at a young age and stuff. But then I was just somebody else who wanted to do something in the arts. So, you know, I gradually kind of moved my life on and such forth. And I found my people, kind of, you know, outsiders like me, who kind of in, you know, the alternative music scene and art scene and whatever. And they were all at university and they were all very smart. You know, we were young adults and we drank a lot and we sat around talking a lot. We played music a lot. We went and saw bands a lot. We talked about books, about cinema, about music, you know, psychology, you know, philosophical shit. I know I wasn't at university, but out of all those conversations, it really felt like I had a degree by the time I was 21. But I did have this sort of sense that everybody had something that I didn't, and I felt like I wasn't really, there was something that would stop me from going to university, that I wasn't smart enough in a particular way or whatever. You know, it turns out, you know, I was smart enough. A few years later, when I was 27, my best friend, he showed me, he lectured at university, and he showed me an essay by one of his students. It was about a book that I'd read previously, and maybe we'd discussed or whatever. And I read it, and I was like, this is very run-of-the-mill and unimpressive. And I asked him, I said, so what grades is this person getting? And he said, oh, they'll be getting an A. And I kind of was like, you're effing kidding me. This is so average. I said, I could do this. And he was like, well, duh. And so I went to university and I loved it. And I wish I'd never left. The thing about how getting a PhD is at the end of it, you hand it in, you get your grade and you get this marvelous response from your examiners. Then there's the sense, the reality hits you about what you have learnt. And what you have learnt is that you don't know anything. Yes, that was my sensation, and a lot of other people I know's sensation. You just feel like an utter moron.
At least you've used some of those skills to create this book, which has been described by Aussie-based writer Craig Cliff as an impressionist self-portrait. The book involves you talking about yourself, but also it's very experimental and it's a work of autofiction. Is that form something that you've really like been exploring for quite a while, autofiction?
No, I don't think I've ever read any autofiction. One of my problems is with this disease is that it really affects your cognitive abilities. It's not just tiredness, it's really about what it does to your brain, especially in my case. So I can't really read. It's the most heartbreaking thing. I can't actually read. I can read small amounts, but it really, really exhausts me. And it's very, very difficult to do. But it was quite cool. One of my examiners for the PhD version of the book, she wrote that while some people might call this book autofiction, a better name for it is actually autotheory, which put a big smile on my face. And she was kind of referring to how the text is kind of always trying to produce kind of literary theory in order to create the self-portrait of the disease, because it's really a self-portrait of the disease, not of me. There's a person in the book called David Coventry. It's not me. It's just a version of me I've made up and for the book. And, you know, it's a well-established fact that my writing is very impressionistic, and this book is probably the least so of my novels. It's just a style that works for me, and it's just how the words come out. And it's a novel, you know, it is a novel. It's not a memoir. There's lots of things that are based on events that have happened in my life or my family's life, but nobody will be able to tell me which bits are fiction and which bits are true with any authority. And I think this has caused some confusion. I don't think people have quite known how to label the book, which is one of the points. The disease is almost unlabelable, and we've never known how to describe it in sensible forms. And it's fitting that the book has not been able to be described in sensible forms either.
I mean, I think you can say it might not be a biography. It is brutally honest. I mean, there's those sections where you're talking about just how the disease works and just staying at home, doing tons of research. I mean, that's real.
As I say, do you know if that's real?
It felt real. It felt very real.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, I did. I had to do a lot of research for the novel and for the PhD. And, you know, there's a section at the end where it sort of describes me at home. There's like two versions of me at home. One doesn't quite fit into the physical realm and is kind of floating there and telling me about my life. And that's kind of a version of the text. It's the textual me sitting there having a conversation with me. Maybe that's the most realistic section of the novel. I don't know. It was certainly fun to write, and I find it quite amusing, that section. I think it's quite funny.
The book itself is prefaced with a quote by the novelist and playwright Thomas Bernhard. The quote is, "Instead of committing suicide, people go to work." What about this resonates with you, and what importance does it have in regard to performance?
One, I just think it's just hilarious and wonderfully funny and witty, and you can spend forever trying to unpick that sentence. It's kind of it's almost a riddle in a way. It's not, but it is, but it's not, but it is. You know, he's just conflating suicide with having a job, you know, and I relate to that very strongly. I really struggled in a normal life to having a normal job, and I found myself very depressed when I did have a normal job. I just really struggled, and I think a lot of that's to do with having ADHD on top of this disease. So yeah, I kind of felt like, you know, I was kind of close to suicide just because I was going to work. You know, there's a certain death. There's a certain death of the self by going to work. As a function in the book, Bernhard plays quite a big role in the text. After about halfway through, he provides kind of a map of how to read performance of the novel.
Using him as kind of a framework.
Yeah, there's quite a long quote I use from one of his books. It's like these really long sentences that keep repeating themselves, attempting to resolve, but they can't resolve. And it's sort of an acknowledgement within the text that you can't resolve any... language will never resolve. It's always trying to mean by various means. And that's the same with the disease. It's inscrutable. We don't know why it exists, how it exists, why it manifests as it does. And that, well, I think it's just a whole page, actually, quote, encapsulates the mysteriousness, frustration of trying to understand the disease. Hence, it provides a kind of key to reading the novel in a way. And you know, it was crazy. He was one of my favourite novelists. And I went to visit my friend in Austria, where Thomas Bernhard is from. I was just about to ask her about Thomas Bernhard, whether she knew anything. And I was at her parents' house, in the middle of nowhere in Austria. Could have been anywhere. And then she suddenly starts talking about him, and it turns out that her father was his dentist. It was just the craziest coincidence. So I went to Bernhard's house. I mean, he obviously died many years before, but I went to his house and I met his brother. They gave me some of his books. It was quite an amazing experience going to the place where he wrote his extremely influential and bizarre and strange and wonderful novels, yeah, and plays.
I want to touch on that idea of things not resolving, because this book, it's very dreamlike, it's very glitchy. There's you talking about you're retelling different stories, and then it'll just automatically jump into you talking about living with ME. When you're writing those sections, when you're writing the book, are you in one mode doing the story and then in a different mode writing about living with Emmy? Or when you're writing it, are you doing it at the same time?
It's neither, really. I'm jumping all over the show when I'm writing. I could be working on the end of the book whilst I still haven't written the beginning of the book. I have an idea and I'm like, I think that goes at this section of the book, and I'll start writing it. And then I'll go back to writing another part of the book. It's very rare for me to write a whole chapter and without having working on something else. In fact, it's rare for me to be working on the same book without rewriting or working on a separate book as well. My brain jumps around a lot because of the ADHD thing, and it's kind of best for me to let it do that rather than try and force it just to work on the one thing. It works for me. It'd probably drive other people insane. It's probably hard for you to understand how that works, but I think there's quite a few writers who write like that. They're not always, you know, they're always jumping around from section to section. It's the trick that we try to pull off to fool the reader that this thing has been written from word one all the way to word two, as in the way that you read the book. Never the case. Well, if it is, it's pretty incredible.
So linearity is something that, yeah, it's definitely alien to your process, because your process is just working on multiple different points simultaneously, and then it just kind of, it ends up where it ends up.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, linearity is not my friend.
Yeah.
And I've learned to work past that. I've learned to make that work for me, yeah.
I want to touch on the section Buckle and Stammer, because there's a section you're writing pretty in-depthly about the long, mid, and short-term motions of living with ME. And towards the end of that section, you write, even the smallest events feel like miracles. For example, changing they are to there when editing. Is writing something that you can kind of you can afford to expend energy on, because it's something that really, you know, it really makes you tick?
Oh yeah, I don't really exist without writing. That's how I kind of feel. I feel very absent from the world if I'm not writing. It's very important that I do it, especially with this disease, because I don't really have much connection with the outside world. The only reason I play in a band, and I physically should not really be doing it. It's way too much for me to be playing in a band. But the only reason I do it is because it connects me to the outside world, and they're my friends, and I wouldn't probably have a relationship with them if I wasn't in a band, or it'd be much less, and that would make me very sad. So I play in my little kind of poppy post-punk kind of slightly gothy rock and roll band with my mates for the very same reason that I write. It just keeps me in the world. Otherwise, you just disappear. There's a organization out there for people with ME, and it's called Millions Missing. And it's because literally we just go missing. Nobody knows about us because we don't. I mean, people do die from it, but not very often. We just kind of isolated from community, and we don't have the energy to speak up. It's too much, especially if you need to do it in a sustained way. So yeah, sorry, back to your question. Yeah, it is my energy. Writing is my energy. That's probably the way to answer it.
It's a must. It's not a nice to have. About the production of performance, you said, "I didn't battle restrictions placed on me. I lent into the pain, disarray, the utter lack of the kind of cognitive functionality an author relies on to keep their text coherent." How do you feel now you've come out the other side of that pain, and would you do it again for the next book?
Oh, I haven't come out to the other side of the pain. It's always there. It's constant. You know, I wish writing the book. My wonderful, lovely ex-wife, Laura. It was quite funny when I finally finished the book or the PhD. She sort of jumped up and down. And she said, "Does that mean you don't have to have ME anymore now you've written the book?" which was quite funny. Every book's really painful. I mean, just doing anything's painful. Sitting here talking to you is incredibly painful. It's nice. I'm enjoying our conversation, but it's but it's really painful.
I guess more about the process of investigating that pain.
Oh, I gotcha.
That's probably different from just the day-to-day.
Yeah, I gotcha. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Of course I will. I'm thinking of writing another version of performance. It'll probably sell as many as this one did, which isn't a hell of a lot, but it intrigues me. So you got to write what intrigues you, and I quite often think of writing another version of it just because it fascinates me. And, you know, the title is perfect. You know, it's a kind of a performance of the disease, and it would just be performance two or one. So yeah, definitely, absolutely, because it's just what I do anyway. Leaning into that pain is just what I do anyway,
and it really reflects perspective no one gets to hear, you know. And I think
that's right.
Really, really incredible. And yeah, maybe we can make it a franchise. Let's get performance two, Electric Boogaloo. Performance three, we'll get marketing onto it. We'll get some toys.
absolutely. It'll be rocking.
Thank you for coming on the program, David. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's really good to talk.
All right, that was a chat with David Coventry, author, who just finished his latest book, Performance. It is out now. It's a really, 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 as I said before in the interview, it's pretty experimental, but I think it's very enlightening, and again, it reflects a perspective, as I say, that you don't really hear about ever. And you can find it at all sorts of different websites, at the Te Heringa Waka University Press website, at Aotearoa Books. There's a bunch of different websites you can find this book, and it has been creating quite a few waves in the Aotearoa literary community, and for good reason. Highly recommend you get your paws on that. All right.
That was a Radio 191 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.